You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, nau mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm joined in the studio by producer Alex. Coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party, I spoke to MP Simon Court about the government's proposed overhaul of the NCEA curriculum to a different curriculum. I also spoke to Angela Ballantyne, a professor of bioethics at the University of Otago, on research she led into medical professionals using AI to transcribe patient notes and the concerns of doing so. Alex, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Emeritus Professor at the University of Auckland, Ruth Benita, about the continued lower excise rate on heated tobacco products and how it plays into combating smoking harm and Aotearoa's smoke-free goals. I also spoke to the chair of the Meningitis Foundation, Jared Rushton, about Pharmac's decision to increase eligibility for the meningococcal B vaccine to all children under 5 and the foundation's desire to see funding expand to all young people.
Here a ho whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, you can text in on 5395 or waimai rānei. Give us a call in studio on 309 387 79. Apologies. Ko e wareware e a hei ana koutou, te whakarongo ki ēnei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te pai tukutuku o Irirangi Pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Let's get into the show.
Time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Simon Court.
Last week, the government announced a proposal to replace NCEA with an alternative educational curriculum. NCEA, which has been in place since 2002, has received mixed responses. In announcing the move, Education Minister Erica Stanford says that due to the flexibility of NCEA, this has come at a cost for young people to develop critical thinking skills and knowledge for future pathways. The proposed changes include replacing NCEA Level 1 with a foundational test solely focusing on numeracy and literacy, replacing NCEA Level 2 and 3 with two new qualifications, requiring students to take 5 subjects and having to pass at least 4 to obtain a certificate. This move is not without its criticisms and concerns, however. For example, many teachers have told RNZ that the changes, which are set to be phased in from next year, are too swift, with teachers saying they will need additional support during the transition process. For our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party Simon Court, I spoke to him about potentially moving away from NCEA. Why are we moving away from NCEA?
Well, in the early 2000s, when NCEA was introduced, New Zealand was often in the top 5 of the international PISA results for student achievement, tested at age 15. Today, we're 23rd for maths. And in each subject, today, students are about a year behind where the same cohort of students were at the start of the century. And that's because NCEA was driven by an ideology that says competition and excellence are bad, and every student should create their own academic adventure. And it's actually meant that diligent students who do work hard and choose robust standards and apply themselves, they do well. But because there are other easier options to achieve NCEA, it means that passing these easy subjects, while you might get the qualification, turns out to be completely unhelpful in real life. And that's why the government is refocusing the secondary education system on excellence and achievement.
One proposed change is to mark clearly out of 100 with grades that make sense to parents such as A, B, C, D and E. Is A for achieved, M for merit and E for excellence that tricky for parents to understand?
It's not just that it's tricky to understand. because if we think about what we're trying to demonstrate to, say, tertiary sector, you know, if you want to go and apply for a course and you know, where there is restricted entry, you're going to need a certain grade, or an employer who wants to know, you know, is this young person actually suitable to come into my business and take on a responsible role? Now, I'll give you a couple of examples. I was speaking to a former tutor at Victoria University of Wellington recently, and he told me that many first-year students have no idea how to structure a sentence, assemble a paragraph, and therefore make coherent arguments in a paper. And, you know, I would contend that if a first-year student can't set out their thinking about a problem in a structured and coherent manner, then they have been poorly prepared by the school system for tertiary education. I've also heard many complaints from employers that I've met who've said not only do they not understand what these NCEA terms mean and whether an achieved or a merit or an excellence in any topic actually reflects what the student or what the graduate is capable of, it means that, you know, they really can't trust them with responsibility, which means they're much more reluctant to hire them. We have to solve this problem of the credibility of the NCEA system, and we have to make sure we transfer real knowledge from people with the knowledge to young people. That's the only way we're going to recover New Zealand's position as a high productivity and hopefully a high income country.
A lot of NCEA students say that the jump from NCEA level 1 to NCEA level 2 is quite a big step up. NCEA level 1 will potentially be changed to a foundational skills award that will solely focus on literacy and numeracy. With what is proposed to replace NCEA level 2, how will the party ensure that the step up does not leave students behind?
Well, you make a good point that foundational literacy and numeracy is really important, because no matter what subjects or careers people choose to pursue, having those foundation skills mean they can operate in the workforce or they can achieve in tertiary education. The difference between foundation and then what you go on to specialise in, look, I mean, that was my experience of the secondary education system, that there were some core subjects that you took at level 1 or year 11, and then in year 12 and 13 you specialised more in, say, you know, mathematics or business and commerce or arts or history, for example. And so, look, that sounds like business as usual to me, and the government's intention, it's not just the ACT Party that supports this, it's a government policy, is that that no matter where students go to school, that they get a universal test and that their outcomes can be judged against a nationally agreed set of standards. And so that's going to be really helpful to identify where schools are failing to deliver and where students need more help.
Although consultations into the proposal are ongoing, have any secondary staff been engaged prior to the government's announcement?
There was a specialist group that the Education Minister, Erica Stanford, engaged with over quite a considerable period of time that the proposals were refined with. Unfortunately, that didn't include the Labor opposition education spokesperson, Willow Jean Prime, who, despite being invited to engage with the group, ignored and then refused to attend. So I'm confident that the government has engaged with those who will be tasked with delivering the system, that is the teachers and principals who will be expected to work with the new standards.
Speaking more to secondary school staff, a lot of teachers have told RNZ that the suggested timeline of introducing the new curriculum or the proposed new curriculum was incredibly tight and that they would require a lot of support. How would the ACT Party and maybe even the wider government propose supporting this potential move from NCEA to teachers?
Well, teachers are right. It is tight. But unfortunately, we've reached a very, very low point and we need to turn this around really quickly. Look, I think the Education Minister, through this consultation phase, the public consultation phase, is going to be looking for the feedback on exactly the kind of support that's going to be necessary. There's no doubt that for a lot of teachers who've graduated teaching college in the past 20 years and who've been teaching to NCEA standards, that they're going to have to step up and they're going to have to be prepared to deliver a much higher quality product in order to meet students' needs. So that's definitely on the horizon, but I'm not over the detail of what decisions have been made about that level of support, but it's definitely going to be necessary.
And what are you expecting we will see regarding the consultation process?
Well, it's a fairly standard time frame, 6 weeks, which is typical for regulation or new legislation that's being passed. That should be sufficient time, more than sufficient really, for those who are really engaged with education outcomes to make their views on the proposal known. And that will also feed into the final design of the system and its implementation and transition phase, which, you know, as many teachers have pointed out, is really, really important so that we can get it right.
That was the ACT Party's Simon Court on the proposed overhaul of NCEA.
That was Simon Court from the ACT Party.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire. In July last year, the government announced a one-year period of lower excise rates on heated tobacco products produced by Philip Morris. Last month, the government extended that period by 2 years, with a valuation now set for July 2027. This move has been seen by some as a tax break or corporate subsidy for Philip Morris, but some have argued that it is a positive step for harm prevention through encouraging smokers to buy healthier nicotine products. I spoke to Emeritus Professor in Population Health at the University of Auckland, Ruth Benita, about the government's move and what it means for Philip Morris and how this will impact the health of New Zealanders. Why is this more complex than just a corporate subsidy?
Well, it's not a corporate subsidy at all. It's money that will be foregone by the government if people take it up. It's a differential tax to try and encourage people to take up a less harmful product. But there might be some confusion about tax and excise tax here. It's a differential tax on a product, hopefully, that is less harmful than the excise tax raised on harmful products.
Why are heated tobacco products something we should be encouraging?
Well, from the evidence we have, it's heating tobacco, not burning tobacco. These products are heating it at a much lower temperature, and that makes the inhalation of the aerosols and toxins from burning tobacco less harmful, presumably. Therefore, it should attract a differentially lower tax.
And is reducing excise tax the best way to do this?
Well, what you want to do is to make the healthier choices the easier and cheaper choices. At the moment, tax is regressive, as it should be, but it hits those. Tax is very hard hitting on those who are smoking. But a differential tax will make those safer products more affordable for those who need them.
And do you understand why there is a lot of cynicism around this move based on the government's other interactions with the smoking industry?
Absolutely. I mean, it's totally inappropriate for the industry to be discussing and lobbying with the government. And in fact, there's no... all countries have signed up to... there being no lobbying from the tobacco industry, but there's a lot of distrust from the past, and rightly so, where the tobacco industry was totally deceitful about promoting the idea that cigarettes were not harmful.
What can be done to combat this kind of cynicism and distrust?
Straight up, we need transparency. We need to be sure that the industry is not having influence on policy. We need to help people understand that moving away from cigarettes is what this is the story's about, not so much in politics of various companies, tobacco companies. The tobacco companies are shifting to less harmful products, and by less harmful, I mean accessing nicotine through any way other than burning tobacco.
And what does this move mean in terms of how our government is currently interacting with the tobacco and smoking industries?
Well, I think they're signalling the fact that they are offering a differential tax, a lower tax on heat-not-burn products, because at the moment all tobacco products are taxed, and this is a safer form of accessing nicotine than burning the tobacco, right? And therefore, it seems that the government is trying to make a healthier choice, an easier choice, by making it cheaper for the consumer. Now, if the tobacco industry, in this case Philip Morris, who has a monopoly on these heated products, doesn't pass the tax on to the consumers, then that needs to be dealt with, and that would be a scandal.
If Philip Morris don't do what is expected of them, what then sort of situation are we looking at? How do we deal with that?
They have already begun. Actually, they have already begun to lower the prices, because a heated stick has already dropped from $17 to $14. The question is that the whole of the excise tax that's being passed on to consumers, or just partial? I think you need to really find out and ask Philip Morris, have they passed on the whole of the tax? They certainly have passed on some.
How does this factor into New Zealand's smoke-free goals as they stand?
Well, that's a very good question, and raising the fact that New Zealand is probably ahead of the game worldwide in reaching the 5% smoke-free goal. That's 5% fewer smoking. This will help accelerate the opportunity for the 200,000 remaining smokers to have a greater option to shift off the deadly cigarette. After all, there's nothing that they can do more readily than move away from this cigarette, which are killing 4,500 people a year and causing a big burden on the health services. Therefore, it seems to me that keeping, allowing, not to leave those behind, the 5% who will be left behind, and which are also people who have the groups that are hardest hit, they have the highest prevalence. That's the older people who find changing more difficult. It's Maori and Pacifica who are smoking at higher rates than others. And I think there's a big opportunity here just to make another product, which is less harmful, more available as an option. Widen the option. It comes back down to make the healthier choices, the easier choices, and the cheaper choices. I think it's a very useful conversation that's been raised to help people understand what it is about smoking that is difficult. It's the smoking that kills. It's not the nicotine that kills. So we're after a smoke-free society, not a nicotine-free society. And that might help people understand why, with the new products that's coming onto the market, which delivers nicotine in a less harmful way, understand why that might be a good thing for New Zealand and for the world in general.
That was the University of Auckland's Ruth Benita on a lower excise rate for heated tobacco products. We'll be right back. Text 5395 with any of your thoughts on these pieces.
All-time indie rock icons Bloc Party are headed back to Aotearoa at last, playing August 12th at Spark Arena.
Celebrating the 20th anniversary of their critically acclaimed debut album, Silent Alarm, Bloc Party are set to play the album in full, plus all the hits that followed it.
The bold and beautiful sound of Bloc Party, back at last, playing Spark Arena on August 12th.
Get your tickets from Ticketmaster, or listen to 95BFM all this week to win a couple.
Thick black mascara and little black curtains. Two little holes in my neck that was bitten. Black velvet capes with stylish bat wings. These are a few of my favourite things.
It's the sound of music, but not as you know it. The 95BFM Monday 1 to 4 with the sinister sister and goth mother superior, Penny Black. Tune in to hear our dark diva spinning nothing but the unholy best from the Devil's Discotheque. Brought to you by Flying Nun Record Store, 202 Karangahape Road.
It's only here. Picky Picky, the debut album from Geneva AM, is out August 15, and we have copies of the vinyl to give away. Just listen in to 95BFM Breakfast all week and keep your B-card handy for your chance to win. Picky Picky, Picky Picky by Geneva AM. Get your pre-orders today. Album out August 15, wherever good music is found.
We'll be right back. shit and fraud.
Do
That song there is I Can't Kick This Feeling When It Hits by Moody Man. And before that was Waste Away by Void Waves. Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Concerns have been raised with medical professionals using AI scribes to transcribe patient notes. This follows research by the University of Otago, where researchers surveyed 197 health providers in February and March last year into their experiences using AI in their practices. 40% surveyed had used AI scribes for patient notes, with most saying they had found AI helpful. However, concerns have been raised over the potential legal and ethical consequences of AI scribing patient notes, such as through data security and patient consent. I spoke to the lead researcher in the study and professor of bioethics at the University of Otago, Wellington, Otako Whakaihu Waka Poneke, Angela Ballantyne, about AI scribing and how AI should be regulated in this space. Here is that interview. Why might a doctor or just medical staff in general use AI scribes to transcribe these notes?
Great question. So I think all of us are aware that the health system is feeling really under stress, under-resourced, and many staff are feeling quite burnt out at the moment. So AI scribes are promising in that context because they offer to do some of the writing work for doctors. So in our study, about 71% of people who had tried them found them helpful or very helpful. And in particular, nearly 50% of those people said that they thought if they used them across an entire day of consulting with patients, they might save between 30 minutes and 2 hours. So I think time saving is a really big sort of selling feature. And then the other thing that doctors found is that, well, actually one GP in particular, we've got a quote where they said, actually, it made my job fun again. So doctors are saying that it reduces the cognitive load, they're feeling less tired at the end of the day, and they feel they can focus more on the patient in front of them rather than the computer.
Are there regulations in place regarding this? And if not, how important is it that regulations are put in place?
Yeah, also a great question. So I think one of the reasons we did the study was because we felt like the technology was rolling out kind of ahead of regulatory readiness. And so one of the problems with that is that these tools are essentially kind of out there, and it's really up to individual GPs or primary health providers to decide whether they use them in their consultation. So there wasn't a lot of regulatory support. If you compare that to something like a pharmaceutical, so for a pharmaceutical to be on the market in New Zealand, it has to have gone through a really rigorous review process through phase one to phase three tests to test the safety and efficacy. And when that drug is approved for market, it's only approved in a very particular formulation, like the pharmaceutical company can't go and change the formula and keep selling it. Whereas AI tools are increasingly going to be quite important in terms of the delivery of healthcare in New Zealand and around the world, but they're really hard to regulate because the point of AI is that it continually learns and develops. So it's hard to pin something down that we've decided is kind of safe and offers utility and has reduced the bias and isn't unfair and so forth, and then pin that down because over time it's going to change. So it's tricky to regulate them. One thing that has happened since our study is that a committee at Health New Zealand is now reviewing particular AI tools. So we now have two AI scribes that have been reviewed and endorsed by that committee as meeting security standards and being in line with New Zealand privacy law. So that's really helpful, I think. It's not the same as a kind of regulatory stamp of approval we get for drugs, but it is something that supports doctors in making decisions about which tools to use.
In your research, what negative sort of outcomes were you seeing come up?
Yeah, so I mean, again, our study was last year, and so it was quite soon after the uptake of these tools. We would expect some of these negative issues to hopefully be improving over time. But in terms of what we found that doctors, while they found them helpful, were mainly concerned about the quality and accuracy of the notes that are produced. So many of our doctors said that they were still finding sometimes what's referred to as hallucinations. That's where the AI model sort of makes up stuff that wasn't in the consultation. The notes were really long and required quite a lot of editing. Sometimes the notes failed to pick up what the doctors saw as quite critical findings that had come up in the consultation, and or they just sort of missed the essence, like they were a little bit off in terms of what was the most important thing out of that consultation. The doctors who were really carefully reviewing the notes found actually sometimes that was more time consuming than just writing the note themselves. So we definitely had variable experience with that. And we also had some doctors who were keen to try using the notes but felt really hesitant because they felt they weren't confident that these tools were ethically kind of acceptable and they weren't sure if they met privacy and legal standards in New Zealand. So hopefully some of that regulatory uncertainty has been cleared up in the meantime. And then in terms of what we're a little bit worried about long term is something called clinical de-skilling and automation bias. So we expect that at the moment, because these tools are new, doctors are spending quite a bit of time reviewing the notes. And as I said, that can be quite time consuming. But we know that over time, people become used to those automated systems and they're much less likely to review them carefully, particularly if most of the time the notes are pretty accurate. And that can lead to something called clinical de-skilling because so part of the problem is sort of framing these notes as like an administrative tool. But actually, we know that, one way of putting this, is that thinking, that writing is thinking. And so preparing the clinical note is actually a really important reflective and cognitive process that the doctor's doing. So we'd be a bit worried about particularly junior doctors being over-reliant on these tools and not actually developing those critical thinking skills.
As you mentioned, this research was conducted last year in February and March, and you've briefly touched on this, but with how AI has evolved over the past year and a half, do you expect the original findings of the research could be different if you were to have done it maybe now even?
Yeah, I mean, so a few things have changed. So there's another group that's done a survey this year, and so in our survey we found that 40% of GPs and primary healthcare staff had already used AI scribes, and the group that did it this early this year found that it had gone up to 68%. So one of the findings is across both studies, we're seeing really quick uptake and interest in these tools. In terms of the error rate, I guess what I can say is you would expect the error rate to be getting better over time. So with other AI tools, for example, ChatGPT, if you've played with that, even like if I asked it to write a profile on myself a year ago, that was more inaccurate than if I asked it to write a profile on me now. So we haven't got evidence that the error rate is declining, and the error rate will never go away completely, but I can say we would expect over time that if people use the tools, they'll probably get more accurate.
Last month, the National Artificial Intelligence and Algorithm Expert Advisory Group at Health New Zealand, Te Whatu Ora, endorsed two AI scribe tools, Heidi Health and iMedX. Do you believe, and you've briefly touched on this as well, but do you believe that the number of health professionals trusting AI will increase heading forward?
I think like any tool, we should move forward with a bit of a dose of healthy scepticism. I guess I'm on that committee. So I engage with groups around AI, and you sometimes get two really strong narratives. One narrative is, this is amazing, it's going to change the efficiency, it's going to save doctors so much time, they're going to feel so much more refreshed. And like I said, you know, we did have some of those positive findings in our study, but I guess my view is that over time, you know, we've had lots of technological innovation, everything from dishwashers to washing machines to an at-home espresso makers to predictive text on our phones. But the sum of all that is not that we're feeling less exhausted. You know, most of us are feeling more exhausted and more anxious than we previously were. So, I mean, I'm skeptical of the idea that these AI tools are dramatically going to improve the experience of healthcare workers and or fill the gap of experienced healthcare workers. On the other hand, you have some real skepticism. You know, AI is sort of evil and it's going to take over the world and it's biased and unfair, which is true, but human decision-making is biased and unfair as well. So I think, will people trust it more? I think both will happen. I think people will become more accustomed to it and they'll trust it. But as we get more used to it, we'll start to see the way that influences clinical decision-making or patient decision-making in unexpected ways. And that might make us a little bit more wary of it as well, which I think is a good thing. I think we should proceed with caution, I suppose, is my advice.
Were patients surveyed in this research as well? And if so, how were they feeling about their notes being AI scribed?
No, that's such a good question. I would love to see research on that. So I think that's obviously the next phase. And in relation to this paper, we've had, you know, some anecdotal feedback from patients. Again, I think there's likely to be a mixed experience. One thing that we'd like people to take away from this study is to A, know that their GPs and primary healthcare providers are likely to be recording the conversations, that they should be given the option to consent to that. So if patients are out there listening and you don't feel comfortable using AI to record the notes for your consultation at the moment, because this is an innovative procedure or tool, you should have the right to say no. So feel free to say no. Also, patients can ask if their doctor is using one of those two, as you said, approved tools, Heidi or iMedic, so they could ask about that if that makes them feel more comfortable. One thing that I'm really interested in, so we know from previous research that wasn't related to AI, that in consultations where the doctor verbalises their reasoning out loud more, this can have a few unintended consequences for patients. So this might make patients feel a bit more confused, hearing that very technical medical language. It can make them more anxious, and it can make them overestimate the seriousness of their condition and therefore actually prefer quite aggressive and maybe even unnecessary treatment options. Now, this verbalisation is necessary, so the doctor will be saying more out loud in the consultation because it needs the scribe to hear that and use it in the transcript, whereas previously the doctor would have been thinking all that in their head and then would have personally put it into the notes at the end of the consult. So I'm really interested in how these AI tools in clinical practice influence that doctor-patient interaction and patients' decision-making around treatment options, but we don't know that yet.
Summarising our chat today, what would you like to see in the space? What regulations would you like to see here?
So I think, as I said, the regulatory space is really tricky in relation to AI. I'd like to see some proactive thinking about that. So I'm pleased that Health New Zealand is investing in an advisory group. So this advisory group can give advice about the use of tools. It's not the same as kind of a regulatory process that gives tools a formal stamp of approval, but that's really helpful. I'd also like to see some thought about, it's a little bit technical, but around liability. So one of the interesting things is that at the moment, the professional and kind of legal standard is that even if doctors use these tools, they remain legally and professionally responsible for the accuracy of any note. So if something goes wrong, it's the doctor's fault. But we know over time that doctors are likely to become very dependent on these AI tools, not just scribes, but across medicine. And it's not yet clear at all if that tool has an error in it and that error results in a patient having bad advice or a poor outcome, who's liable for that. So lots of groups overseas are looking at this at the moment, and I think in the different models for dealing with that. But I think it would be really great to see New Zealand proactively thinking about the influence of AI in our health system sort of 10 years from now, rather than being reactive to that.
That was the University of Otago's Angela Ballantyne on the concerns with AI scribing patient notes. We'll be right back.
Astonishing.
My fear of betrayal.
and St. Helens is underneath the stars. Just know I've cleared the way. Just know I won't leave as I came. Just know I'll keep the mirror you gave. Just know I won't. I won't leave as I came. I won't leave as I came. You make me want to be ready. I feel different now than I did before. I can see how my power only was my fear of betrayal. Like a tornado in the dark, I can see us laying face to face as St. Helens is underneath the stars.
Welcome back to The Wire. That was Cinderella by Model Actress and Taxes by Geese.
So it's a very odd time to be alive, as they say.
The Wire.
At the end of July, Pharmac made the decision to expand eligibility to a fully funded meningococcal B vaccine to all children under five. This decision has been supported and welcomed by the Meningitis Foundation, who say it will benefit over 70,000 children in New Zealand. Now, the foundation is calling for eligibility to be increased to a higher age limit to account for all young people in New Zealand. Currently, younger people's access to the funded vaccine is dependent on whether or not they fit a specific criteria, such as a first year student in halls, and the foundation believes that young people would benefit greatly from the expanding of these criteria to cover a larger portion of the vulnerable young population. I spoke to Gerard Rushton, the chair of the Meningitis Foundation, about Pharmac's decision, how meningitis affects young people, and why we should be expanding the eligibility to take care of young New Zealanders. Why is increasing the comprehensiveness of meningococcal protection so important?
Look, we see that there's an increase in the numbers of meningococcal cases in adolescents. And that's purely because the funding criteria for those to be eligible is far too narrow. We've seen a fantastic uptake with the program that was implemented in March 2024, for babies and 3 to 5 year olds. So we're just calling for that to be extended to the adolescents as well.
With the government's Pharmac's move, to increase it up to the age of five, what sort of health incomes will we hopefully see with this decision?
The health outcomes, we just want to make sure that we are increasing the number of people that are actually protected. There's a complete, but there's a real lack of awareness around meningitis and the need to protect our whānau from meningococcal disease. So, increasing the criteria for 3 to 5 year olds is really important because, as I said, there has been a lack of awareness. The foundation is committed to raising awareness, and we just would like Health New Zealand to actually have a campaign to raise awareness as well, because the vaccination rates are not good enough in New Zealand.
You've mentioned the adolescents, and this is what the Meningitis Foundation's kind of pushing for. But what is the current risk level for those adolescents like, and what currently do we have to protect those age ranges?
So currently, for adolescents, the only ones that can get free vaccination are first-year boarding schools, first-year in the halls of residence, and those in prisons, barracks. So we feel that that's just too narrow, that range is just too narrow. Why do we just protect those that are in halls of residence in the first year? We think that everyone in New Zealand should be afforded the eligibility to be protected from meningococcal disease. So we have a high number of our cases presently are Māori and Pacifica, and we feel that they're underrepresented in first-year halls of residence or boarding schools. So we're just calling for Pharmac and the government to widen the access to all our adolescents.
The Meningitis Foundation are calling for full funding. Would that look different to just an expanded eligibility, or are we talking more of a all-encompassing program?
The ultimate for us is to have free vaccination for everyone. We have put a proposal to the minister in the last couple of weeks to make it free for all those people with community services cards. So we believe that while that's not perfect, it would help those that can least afford to pay for the vaccinations. So that's a proposal we've put to the minister, and we're just waiting to see a response from that.
How would this further expansion affect young people and their communities and how they interact with meningitis?
Meningitis, the issue with meningitis is that it can kill so quickly. The number of meningitis cases in New Zealand is not high, but the mortality and morbidity rate is quite high, and that's why we need to protect our young people, because The symptoms are often flu-like, so can be confused with the common flu, and with it being able to take a life within 24 hours, protection is the only answer, because often treatment comes too late.
You've spoken a lot about awareness. What other kinds of awareness do you want to see with meningitis in New Zealand?
We just want everyone to be aware that they need to protect the young people. The foundation is involved with a number of projects. We're just launching some more colouring in books now for young people to teach them about the value of protecting themselves from by vaccination. And yeah, we'd just like to see Health New Zealand embark on a comprehensive awareness campaign so that people are actually aware that they need to protect themselves. Because fundamentally, the underlying factor in most meningitis cases is that people are simply not aware that they need to protect themselves from this disease.
Returning to the expansions or potential expansions, do you foresee a sort of incremental expansion progress towards those older age ranges, or do you just want to see PharmAct go all for funding?
This is one of the issues with the present criteria, is that it is quite confusing to people. So, we see now that first year halls of residence at university to qualify. What's the difference between someone in the first year to someone in halls of residence to someone in a flat? So it's the confusion around the criteria which is causing some issue at the moment as well. So that's why we think that we just need to broaden that criteria and make it eligible for everyone.
Are there any logistical concerns for this kind of expansion?
No, logistical concerns are not an issue with this. We've presented a number of fiscal cases to Te Whareora, showing that the cost to society of meningococcal cases and meningitis far exceeds what it would cost to implement a vaccination program. So fiscally, this program stacks up. So and it fits right with the with Minister Seymour's letter of expectation to PharmAct to take into account the social return on investment for medicines.
That was the chair of the Meningitis Foundation, Gerard Rushton, on PharmAct's expansion of meningococcal vaccine eligibility and what comes next.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Monday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The ACT Party's Simon Court, the University of Auckland's Ruth Bonita, the University of Otago's Angela Ballantyne, and the Meningitis Foundation Aotearoa New Zealand's Gerard Rushton. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.